All right. Are both sides ready to proceed? Yes? All right. And Mr. Stein, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
4 minutes.
4 minutes? Okay. You can go ahead and get started whenever you're ready. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Michael Stein. I represent the appellant LV.net and Marty Mizrahi. The threshold issue Cheetah raises under the Yaling Hung case is that it bars our challenges. It does not. And I'll address that first. I'll then turn to fraud, the damages calculation, prejudgment interest, attorney's fees, the untimely cross appeal, and punitive damages. First, we did address the implied covenant of good faith and the breach of the implied covenant of good faith and the fiduciary duty. Our opening brief at page 26 argues that Mr. Mizrahi cannot be liable for breaching any covenant in agreement to which he was never a party. That defeats both the tortious breach of the covenant of good faith fair dealing and the contractual covenant claims. Our opening brief at page 18 through 19 argues that the Moo expressly disclaimed joint venture, partnership, agency, employer, employee relationships, every element that would be required for the special relationship that would be required for that breach of fiduciary duty. So that negates both the special relationship for the tortious breach claim and the fiduciary duty claim. Challenging the fundamental elements is challenging the claims. Hung is distinguishable as well. In the Hung case, it involved four procedurally distinct grounds with different legal elements: personal jurisdiction, failure to join parties, failure to state a claim, and form nonconvenience. Each was a separate legal document. Here, all six causes of action arise from the same Moo, same parties, same evidence, and as the district court found, yielded the same damages. The district court's own language defeats the independent grounds. The contractual covenant, the district court said, awardable compensation damages are those granted to Cheetah for breach of contract, discussed supra. The fiduciary duty claim, damages are subsumed with those previously awarded. The fraud claim, it's duplicative of monies provided previously awarded under the contract claim. Even Cheetah's own admission in its answering brief at page 25, same damages, but under various theories, the court could not award duplicate damages. If damages are the same, there are alternative theories, not independent grounds. And because Mr. Mizrahi did not breach a contract, had no fiduciary duty, and was not a party to the Moo, there can be no finding of breach of contract, breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, or the tortious breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing as to him. The subpart elements of
Mr. Stein, can you just clarify, am I correct, and there was a lot to review on this case, that Mr. Mizrahi, the only damages directly awarded against him personally are the $250,000 punitive damages, is that right?
No, the judge found the breaches against him as well, I believe.
Did she enter a judgment for the compensatory damages against him?
I believe that is accurate.
Okay. Maybe I missed something. Very possible.
I'll review. I believe that is correct. Because you couldn't award the punitive damages unless there was an underlying claim against him.
I agree.
Okay. Well, I'm off to a good start then.
Before we leave that point, though, I had the same question, which is on page 49 of the district court's order, which awards the $1,245,000, it says, against LVNet only. Mm-hmm. And then it says it awards the only under those claims. And then it says it awards punitives against LVNet and Mizrahi jointly and severally. And so I read that to say that there had been an award of punitives without the underlying compensatory damages that are required for such an award.
Yeah, that clarifies what I was misunderstanding, yes.
Okay, so So that's an issue on this appeal, that Mizrahi should not have been tagged with punitives because there was no
underlying
compensatory.
Right.
Thank you.
So even if this court would affirm liability on any theory, the damages error surviving the penalty, the hallmark methodology violations, the prejudgment interest calculation errors, and the punitive damage procedural failures, each warrant relief, regardless if there was a liability outcome.
I'm sorry, I got to interrupt you.
Yes,
I'm so sorry. So now I'm looking at the order entered by the court after there was post-judgment motion practice. The order filed November 14, 2024, at the record, page 819 it starts. But on the second page of that order, it says, so it's granting the motion to clarify. The $1,245,000 judgment was entered against defendant LVNet LLC, period. Plaintiff's punitive damages award was against defendants Mizrahi and LV.net LLC jointly, and I'm going to assume that's supposed to be severally and not severely. Is that it? Was there not compensatory damages awarded against Mr. Mizrahi?
That you've clarified what I was losing
okay.
my mind. Yeah, that is correct.
Okay.
We are in agreement on that.
Okay.
And this is part of why this hung application either way isn't properly applicable in this situation.
But counsel, in your briefings to our court, you didn't really raise that issue. In terms of there not being compensatory damages. There's a passing reference to it only to make a comparison on some other related issue, but nothing, there's no direct argument by you that punitive damages shouldn't have been awarded because there were no underlying compensatory damages. Was that because you assumed that the compensatory damages were also against Mr. Mizrahi?
I may have thought that when I was writing that, when I through the confusion, right. But there's still sufficient reasons why punitives can't be awarded. Obviously, NRS 42050053 states that punitive damages must be determined in a subsequent proceeding. And that's
what
mandatory.
What would be the sense of that in a court-tried case? Like in a jury trial case, you don't want to put in the net worth of the defendant against whom the plaintiffs are seeking to tag punitive damages.
Because
so
that,
you wait till they have the liability determined. But there's a rule that when the purpose of a rule ceases, so too should the rule. And I'm like, why would we reverse and have to order a separate punitive damage proceeding against the very same judge that determined liability for punitive damages and liability on the other claims?
Well, the first reason, it's statutory and it's mandatory. It's not discretionary. So you have to. Second, the issues that you cover in such a hearing were not covered in the trial. So all of the elements that the court's supposed to look through and hear didn't go through at the time of the trial.
Were there not, like, hearings with the judge about planning what they were going to do during the bench trial and what days they were using and whether there would need to be a subsequent proceeding on punitive damages?
This was a very strange case for me.
Let me say, you were not counsel below. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
But in trying to decipher this and read through what was incredibly long and arduous transcripts,
yes.
One of the things that I found that I think is fair to the court and fair to the parties, that this was in the middle of COVID period, and I think that made things difficult for everyone. And that is what I got out of this. I don't think that it was, I'm making arguments of errors of law, but not of mismanagement of judges and lawyers. I want to be clear about that.
Right.
So it was a strange time, Justice, and I think that some of these things that might have just normally been done just didn't work out because of the strangeness of COVID.
So once the judge issued a ruling that ordered punitive damages, did anybody say, hey, judge, the statute says we're supposed to have a separate proceeding, and I didn't get to put in X, Y, and Z evidence?
It's a great question, but the punitive damages only came out in the final judgment. That was the first time they appeared. So once there was a final judgment, then counsel had a choice. They could have tried to do a motion that may have been found.
They did file a motion to clarify the judgment, but it apparently didn't cover this issue.
That's true, but they don't have to. There's a final judgment. So one route could be just to appeal on the final judgment. And in many ways, it's a safer route for lawyers because you avoid any error or concerns about tolling motions. And we've seen in this case how that can become a big problem.
What evidence would your client have presented if that wasn't presented if there had been that separate punitive damages proceeding?
They would have walked through all of the elements that the statute requires and that the case law requires, the BMW case.
But the separate proceeding in the statute is only to determine the amount of the punitive damages. The liability for oppression, fraud, or malice, express or implied, or whatever the statute 42005 says, that's determined in the main proceeding with just a little proceeding to follow that says, okay, here's the net worth of the defendant, and the amount of the punitive damages liability for which was determined in the main proceeding is X. So without a proffer of some difference as to the net worth or the valuation, I'm not sure, even if there was a statutory violation technically, that there's any harm that would justify reversal.
The finding in the underlying statute, or the underlying case, will make a finding of, let's say, fraud, okay, which might make you susceptible to a punitive damage award. It's not a guarantee. And this is, you look at these issues in that the BMW Vigor analysis should have had, and then you look at, you know, financial condition, all that, to determine how much of a punitive damage award. Maybe a punitive damage award may have been a dollar.
Were those documents listed as potential exhibits in the pretrial memo or whatever was done in advance of trial in this case?
I don't believe they were, but I think that is also why you have a subsequent hearing, to allow presentation of that evidence, because it's not part of the underlying trial.
But they weren't listed as potential exhibits.
For the underlying trial, correct.
The punitive damages is part of the same trial.
I don't agree with that. It's a separate hearing. It's independent of the underlying trial. And I think that is where this comes up. Because first you have to find liability. Because otherwise you would be presenting documents that ordinarily courts don't require. Tax returns, financial conditions would all be put into a record that are normally not required. And then they come in later if there is even finding of liability that would trigger a requirement for punitive damages. It would be unfair to require a party to do that, put in all these sensitive documents before they're found liable for something that might make them liable also in the separate statutorily required mandatory hearing for the punitive damages. I'd like to circle back to the fraud claim. The fraud requires clear and convincing evidence of knowing falsity. So when Leslie said the move was poorly written, that following it may not be possible, when Expert Witness Weekly called it poorly written, when Dean admitted it was ambiguous, when Mr. Gonzalez said revenue wasn't defined, and when Mr. Flanagan couldn't understand whose customers are who, the legal conclusion that someone committed fraud by interpreting it differently, it just can't stand. Mr. Mizrahi during trial said, everybody said it's ambiguous, nobody understands it. Mr. Whiteman, an expert, said no conclusions of law as to the meanings of the ambiguous statements. And Mr. Weekly said, well, Mr. Gonzalez said one thing and Mr. Mizrahi said anything, so I'm going to follow Mr. Gonzalez. He's the one paying me.
The judge presiding over the bench trial here found that your client, that Mr. Mizrahi, had made misrepresentations of fact, knowing that they were either knowing or with reckless disregard for the truth or falsity.
The statements of fact go to the interpretation of what is required under the contract. So we don't challenge credibility. We challenge the legal standard. Contract interpretation is de novo under the American First Credit Union case. And fraud requires clear and convincing evidence of knowing falsity. When five witnesses, including Cheetah's own expert investor, described the move as poorly written, confusing, or ambiguous, knowing falsity, I think, is a legal impossibility.
But even outside of the terms of the contract, there were several acts of conduct that the court found would also constitute in support of a finding of fraud, like the 24 invoices and receipts, the making up labor costs and expenses, charging Cheetah for luxury cars, you know, all of these other things that were kind of outside of the bounds of the contract, or if you want to say it was performing under the contract in a fraudulent way. So, I mean, there were significant findings, I think, in the record to support a finding of fraud.
But even if it's true that there was a fraudulent statement about something, it doesn't mean that every aspect of this breach and all the damages come from that. And they were never determined, what did that fraud cost you? What was the cause of that? What are the damages as a result of that specific statement? So, I mean, I think this is helpful. The district court's own characterization was, it's an unartfully written but not ambiguous. It's internally internally contradictory and legally erroneous. If the moo was unartfully written enough that sophisticated parties and their experts couldn't agree on what it meant, I think it's ambiguous as a matter of law. And if it's ambiguous, on top of the fact that under the hallmark,
the fact that the contract's ambiguous doesn't mean somebody can't commit fraud if they make a representation of fact and then, like, and know that it's a misrepresentation.
I agree with that, but what I'm saying is that if there is a fraud, the damages have to meet what the fraud is. In this case, the damages were assumed in the entire alleged breach of contract case. So we don't know what the fraud damage caused, if there was fraud. If there was the invoices the judge found as a matter of fact, to be untruthful and knowingly untruthful, what was the damage caused by that? And she said it was just assumed into the contract damages. So there is no damages assessed to the fraud independently.
Well, it doesn't appear that the court awarded compensatory damages on the fraud claim.
Right, but you can't have punitive damages without the fraud.
I understand.
So that is the hiccup here. And then when you look at the way the damages were calculated in violation of Hallmark, and they abdicated even finding whether or not he was qualified.
You may have noticed folks had a few questions. So
yeah, a lot of questions. That's fine.
Add 2 minutes to your time for rebuttal, and we'll give two minutes to counsel for the respondent as well. You can get started. Thank you.
This case involved a business dispute, a business venture that went terribly wrong, not because there was a dispute over ambiguous contract terms, but because the defendant engaged in pervasive fraud, self-dealing, and theft. The evidence was so compelling that the district court judge equated his conduct with extortion. The defendant would repeatedly promise that profit payments were forthcoming, and when those dates arrived, he doctored the financial records to ensure that it wouldn't happen. The evidence was so egregious, we uncovered proof of him buying luxury sport cars and charging that to Cheetah as an expense. We uncovered evidence of him going to casinos, pulling out large amounts of cash for he and his family members, and then booking that as a construction expense to Cheetah. Now, the district court sat and listened to 21 days of testimony. She considered post-trial briefs, and then she rendered a very detailed 50-page decision in which Cheetah prevailed on all 7 of its claims for relief. All of the tort claims were against both Mr. Mizrahi and LVN together, and the 2 contract claims were just against the company. And Cheetah was awarded the same compensatory award across all 7 of those claims for relief. Now, the defendants have adopted a kitchen sink approach here to this appeal. However, they did make a fatal mistake, in my opinion, in not challenging 3 of the causes of action in which we prevailed: breach of fiduciary duty, the contractual implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and just and unjust enrichment. And we cited case law, including the Hong case from our intermediate appellate court, which is clear that their failure to challenge all of those causes of action that provide for this the same underlying damages waives their right to challenge other claims. Now, incredibly, they didn't even respond to this position in their reply brief. This is the first time you hear counsel saying anything about the Hung case or this position. So it's our position the court should not consider any of their liability challenges and limit the focus of this appeal to the various monetary awards. And in that regard, we would ask that the court affirm the district court's judgment in all respects, except to make clear that the compensatory award and attorney's fees are against both defendants. And you've raised this issue, and I want to get into that.
Well, if the district judge didn't impose it against him individually and you didn't cross-appeal, what's the...
Well, I think she did, and here's where I want to get into that. Substantively, the findings of fact and conclusions of law are very clear that we prevailed against both LVN and Mr. Mizrahi on all tort claims, fraud, breach of fiduciary duty, tortious breach of the implied covenant, and conversion. If you look, each of those claims obviously had elements that included damages, and the damages were awarded across all of those tort claims in the amount of $1,245,875, plus the punitive damages. Now, this is important. If you look at paragraph 32 of the findings of fact and conclusions of law, the court stated there with respect to the breach of fiduciary duty claim, quote, Cheetah sustained damages as a result of the breach of fiduciary duty. However, again, those damages are subsumed within those previously awarded. And again, that claim, all of the tort claims were very clear in the findings of fact and conclusions of law that they were against both defendants. All of those claims have damages as a necessary element, so proved.
But then explain to me the court's own order interpreting the court's own judgment on a motion for clarification, which says the $1,245,000 judgment was entered against defendant LV.net LLC, period.
I agree with you. It's confusing, and that's why we're asking this court to say that's a mistake and clarify that issue. And here's why it's confusing to me. We had post-trial motions, or attorney's fees and costs. We went to a hearing. We cited this, attached the transcript to these proceedings, and the court held, quote, with respect to the breach of just one of these claims, with respect to the breach of the implied covenant and fair dealing claims, I did award the damages to the compensatory damages to CWTI against both Mr. Mizrahi and LV.net. I simply noted that the awardable compensatory damages arising from the claim were the same as those granted with respect to the breach of contract, quantum merit, unjust enrichment, which I had previously discussed.
So that's what she said in court at the hearing?
She said that in court at a hearing on the cost motion.
Oh.
And then she issues the cost decision, and we've attached this as well. December 29, 2023, she issued an order on the motion to retax costs, and it says in there, quote, on August 14, 2023, this court issued its 50-page findings of fact, conclusions of law, and judgment awarding CWTI as against LV.net and Mr. Mizrahi $1,245,875 in compensatory damages. That's why it was confusing to us. It was very clear in the findings of fact and conclusions of law and the things that preceded that. It only became unclear when we got the attorney's fees order and it said that it was only against Mizrahi. That's when we filed the motion for clarification, and then the court apparently
court
either
clarified it right.
I mean, there's been inconsistent statements, I guess. The decision is clear. I guess I would fall back to the law. Each of these causes of action has damages as a necessary element. The court said we prevailed on all of the tort claims, and it's clear, she's not disputing, we prevailed against Mizrahi and the company on these tort claims. And she awarded a single set of damages, compensatory damages, for those four tort claims. So necessarily it has to be against Mizrahi. We won against Mr. Mizrahi on fraud.
Am I correct that the only appeal filed on behalf of your clients is a challenge on the attorney's fees?
Correct.
So you didn't file a cross appeal saying hey, the judgment needs to also be against Mr. Mizrahi for the compensatory damages.
Because it didn't appear to be an issue at the time, because the compensatory award, I mean, the findings of fact and conclusions of law were clear.
So the clarification came, is chronologically, I just want to understand, the clarification order came after the briefing on the underlying appeal, well, or at least after the notice of appeal time.
Yes.
Okay.
And then there's inconsistencies that she says, the judge says on the record with respect to post-trial briefs that she was applying the we won on the tort claims against both and that damage figure applied to both. It's in an actual order, aside from the findings of facts and conclusions of the law, it's in the cost order. It wasn't until that attorney's fees order that it changed. So there is some confusion here, but I think if you look at the law, she says we prevailed against both parties. We met our burden of proof on fraud and breach of fiduciary duty. And again, a necessary element is damages. She awarded damages, said they apply against all those things. So necessarily it has to apply to both of them.
But to Justice Kadish's point, the clarification order saying the compensatory damages are only against Las Vegas Net was in November of 24, yeah?
Yes.
And then your answering brief and cross appeal here was July of 25?
It was within a week or two of that clarification order. I think we cross appealed within the 2 weeks that we were required to cross appeal from that clarification order.
Yeah, it looks like it fell through the cracks.
This court had sent out to the judge and said, hey, we need a ruling on this. She ruled, and then we immediately filed a cross appeal.
Okay.
So it's our position that the compensatory award and attorney's fees necessarily have to apply against both. She found liability with respect to both on the tort claims. A necessary element is the damage award. She's determined the damage award. It's a liquidated amount. It necessarily needs to apply to both, and that, of course, provides a basis then for her punitive damage award. There were some questions raised about the necessity of a subsequent hearing. I was boots on the ground. I was trial counsel. They never asked for that. Punitive damage was a focus of our case from day one. It was in our complaint. It was in our pretrial briefing. We had pretrial briefs in lieu of opening statements. We put on evidence of financial condition at trial, tax returns, luxury homes that he was buying, luxury cars that he was buying. We put on this evidence without objection. We did closing briefs. We requested punitive damages. They never said, wait a minute, you need to have a subsequent hearing. She issues her judgment, and then they don't file anything. So I think they've waived.
So there was no objection to proof of financial condition in the main proceeding?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
None whatsoever. There was never a suggestion that we need to have a subsequent proceeding. When the decision came out, they could have filed something and said, hey, wait a minute, we need to have a subsequent proceeding. So I think it's waived, but regardless, I think it's harmless error. They would have to show that there would be a different result if you sent it back down. Like you said, it's the same judge that's already heard this evidence. What new financial information is she going to hear that's going to change that position? I just think it's a non-issue, but at worst case, this court would remand for the limited purpose of having the subsequent hearing.
The question I have on the failure to name Mizrahi in the judgment as obligated for compensatory damages is whether or not the claims themselves for breach of fiduciary duty and fraud, which are the only ones that would support the punitives. What did Mizrahi, as distinct from LV Net, do that justified the imposition of liability on those theories against him personally?
Well, of course, a company can only act through its representatives, right?
And I understand
Mr. Mizrahi was LV.net. He was the one making the representations. He was the one inducing Cheetah to do things
but
under
the
false
benefits
pretenses.
Ran to LV Net. And the contract was with LV.net, right?
The contract was with LV.net. But Mr. Mizrahi was the one controlling the MOU spreadsheet. He's the one that induced Cheetah to turn over its cash, the bank accounts, control over the accounting to him. And he's the one that made promises to a payment, that they were going to be getting profits, et cetera. And then he was the one cooking the books. He was the one doctoring the records. He's the one that was out running personal expenses through the business, pulling cash out, running it through, creating...
Was there any kind of piercing the corporate veil argument?
We did make that argument.
You did or did not?
We did.
Okay.
It's in our complaint,
okay.
Yes. But I think it's very clear on each of these tort causes of action. Again, I'll refer to paragraph 32 of the findings of fact and conclusions of law. This is breach of fiduciary duty. Court finds the evidence of a fiduciary relationship and duty did exist between the parties when LV.net LLC and Mr. Mizrahi acquired full control of Cheetah's cash, bank accounts, and financial records. And she goes on to conclude that we sustained damages as a result of that breach, and the damages are the same amount that she had talked about before, the $1.2 million. That's why I say it's clear to me in the findings of fact and conclusions of law, the meat of this decision, that the damages were awarded against both.
So, Mr. Whittle, given that Mr. Mizrahi is, as you just acknowledged, not a party to the contract at issue, how can he be liable on a theory of breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, which is, by its own terms, an implied covenant implied in the contract that he's not a party to?
I understand that position on the tortious breach of implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. I think the answer goes back to, one, the company can't act outside of him. Two, we pled a unity of interest, and I think we proved that at the trial.
Did the court find that?
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, but as a predicate, you have to have a breach of contract. I mean, you have to have the, like, you can't have one without the other, right? You have to have both a breach of contract, and then you have to, and then you can prove the tortious breach. But you can't do that without a contract, and I don't think that there were contract claims brought against Mr. Mizrahi individually.
No, I would concede that he was not a party to the contract, but paragraph 8 of our complaints says that there was a unity of interest between he and the company such that they were indistinguishable from each other.
But did the court find that he was an alter ego?
I don't think the court used those words.
Really?
But he certainly ignored corporate formalities. There was testimony of that at trial, and he was the one controlling the MLU spreadsheet. There was testimony and findings that was his baby. He was the one personally cooking the books. He was deceiving. But, you know, it's a point well taken, in terms of him. It has nothing to do, of course, with those claims against the company. But it's still, you still have claims of breach of fiduciary duty and fraud against him. So,
could you speak briefly about, and we didn't give counsel a chance to address this, but I was just a little curious about the dueling prejudgment interest calculations under NRS 99 and NRS 17. It appears that the court lumped all of the damages into one liquidated amount and then used NRS 17. Las Vegas.net is arguing that she should have done it. Oh, I'm sorry, reverse that. She did it under the N99, and they're arguing it should have been under 17.
No.
Vice versa.
I had it right the first time? Okay, I don't know what I'm doing here. So, okay. So could you just explain?
Sure. I typically in bench trials, you get a judgment, and then you file a motion seeking interest. The court did this, took that on itself in this case. If the question is, do I think it was appropriate for the court to use 17.130, I think the answer is yes, because we had mixed theories of relief, both contract and tort. 17.130 is sort of the catch-all where there's no rate of interest provided by contract or law. 99.040 is for breaches of contract, monies due and owing. I think the issue is this. Obviously, the why it's significant to them is because there's a different triggering date. But
is it based on that the different rate of interest is what we're getting here? Because
I think,
under 99, presumably the interest would start running earlier than under 17. But so rate, the issue is the rate of interest.
Rates changed.
Got it.
Yeah.
Quite dramatically, actually.
Look, I think forcing the district court into a breach date type analysis under 99040 would have been very difficult, if not impossible, because there was no single date to capture when Cheetah was injured in this case. During this relationship, Mr. Mizrahi was converting assets, falsifying records, cooking the books. I mean, this was an ongoing thing. It wasn't like you can pinpoint one time when this happened. So I think service of the complaint, which is what 17130 does, is a non-controversial record-based date to accrue interest. So, but I think the answer to your question, even if the court feels that the analysis should have been under 99, the answer would be the remedy would be either recalculated under that statute or to remand it to the district court for the limited purpose of doing that. But I think it was appropriate.
Because the damages were the same for every cause of action, even if you eliminate the contract causes of action, 17 would have applied and the amount's going to be the same, right?
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. And there were no damages incurred that postdated the filing of the complaint that were proved?
Again,
in that calculation. So we don't have any kind of post-complaint.
Well, the conduct was ongoing, so it would be it's a little difficult to pinpoint dates of breach here because he continued to they took our assets, they took our cash, they took the inventory, they took all the customers, they claimed them as their own, they never gave it back. Right, right.
Okay. Could you briefly touch on the tortious breach of just in terms of the substance of it, what was the special relationship between the parties? Such that this, setting aside that there's no breach of contract claim against Mr. Mizrahi, what about counsel's arguments to that?
I think the court got it correct when she found a special or fiduciary relationship existed when Mr. Mizrahi convinced Mr. Gonzalez to merge the bank accounts and the accounting functions, and he took control of that. Obviously, that wasn't part of the contract. It was opposite of what was supposed to happen, but he did that.
But the MOU disclaimed any type of partnership, joint venture, or special relationship.
It did, but that obviously changed. He induced our side to relinquish control under these veiled threats that you're going to get a judgment against you. You're going to be subject to levy and all these things. And so
that was veiled.
Yeah, yeah. So they did it, and then that was sort of the beginning of the end for my client. He took control and he cooked the books and doctored things and engaged in extensive fraud. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justice. I'll touch on the interest issue quickly. Cheetah's argument fails because the district court made no findings allocating damages among the various theories of recovery. And under the Evans case, where damages are awarded on multiple theories, the court has to specify which damages flow from which legal theory. The court must specify and so we can properly calculate the interest. This is not something you remand back and the judge now makes the correct calculation when they just took a lump sum and just applied this high interest rate under 17, because the evidence has to come in when there are specific breaches under the different theories, and there wasn't. So when everything got assumed under a contract breach, then the contract rate of interest under NRS 99, I think it's 0.040, should have been applied, which is so substantially less than the other one for the torts. And if you're going to apply such a high interest rate under the torts, then you have to know when that tort actually happened to start accruing interest from that time. And they didn't provide evidence to the court when all these things happened and then their damages flowed from it. And this touches to what I spoke to earlier about stating what were your damages from that specific tort. If they were just assumed by the contract one because the contract is so large, even if there was a fraud, was there even a damage from those representations? And then the statement that, well, it's all because Mr. Mizrahi took over the books. But the testimony was clear. Ms. Bennett, who was like a bookkeeper or the in-house accountant for Cheetah's, had full access to the Platypus, to the QuickBooks. She had everything. So this idea that you didn't have access to everything is incorrect. And when Mr. Mizrahi was saying he's making significant changes, she emailed Mr. Gonzalez and the investor saying, Mr. Mizrahi says he's going to do these things. They were on notice of what he was doing. So calling that fraud and taking over seems it's just wrong. That's not what fraud is, when you tell somebody what you're doing. Any other questions?
No, I think we're good.